From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Athens, Georgia has a problem with partying.
Looks like somebody forgot there's a rule against alcoholic beverages. Infraternities on probation.
Tool.
I didn't get that, son. What was that?
I said, what a shame that a few bad apples have to spoil a good time for everyone by breaking the rules.
Put a sock on it, boy.
Could more rules like the ban on new bars in downtown Athens sober up the town? We'll talk about public policy and the psychology of binge drinking this hour. First, though, Hector Fernandez yesterday broke down the difference between Hispanic and Latino.
Hispanic means, whether you like it or not, you're prioritizing, you're giving more importance to your European descent.
Here are your first thoughts. Gabriela Guardia writes, when I first came to the U.S., I only saw myself as Panamanian or Panamanian-American. The terms Hispanic-Latino were forced on me. Many times I chose not to identify with those terms in documents and was mad when I saw them used as a race. For races, I either check all that apply or none. We always love to get your thoughts, so give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Plans to build two nuclear reactors at a Georgia power plant may be in jeopardy. That's after the main contractor on the project near Waynesboro filed for bankruptcy protection last month. Sue Sturgis has been tracking this for the online energy magazine Facing South, and she joins me from Raleigh. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
And also with us is Georgia Public Service Commissioner Tim Echols. It's good to have you as well.
Great to be here in studio.
So, Sue, what happened? Why did did we know that Westinghouse was going to file for bankruptcy protection, or did it come as a surprise?
There were hints that all was not well at Westinghouse, and I don't think it took people completely by surprise that they filed for bankruptcy last month.
So, Tim, I want to play you this comment by from Taylor Smoot of the Augusta Industrial Services. That company inspects the reactors that are currently in development. Here's what he thinks. He thinks work will not stop.
I don't see where they would just leave a monument, so to speak. You know, what's there, just abandon it. I think they've gone too far into it to just completely stop. If they didn't finish, they'll finish three and maybe a couple of years down the road, come back and finish four.
So is inevitably the nuclear reactors will be finished?
No, I don't think so. And he doesn't serve on the Georgia Public Service Commission. And my colleagues and I, as we look at this estimate to complete that the power company is going to bring us, that number will determine whether we move forward and do just what the soundbite said, or whether we convert one of those to natural gas or convert both of them to natural gas. I mean, there is a chance that we would do something other than finish the reactors.
There have already been, I mean, the Plant Vogtle has already been controversial for a number of reasons. Number one, the costs have risen to $8 billion as of December, and there have been a number of delays. What does this Westinghouse bankruptcy sort of, is it sort of the cap on what's been a troubled timeline?
I mean, the whole project has, you know, been slower than we had anticipated, more expensive than we had anticipated. And I think that's going to factor into my fellow commissioners as they evaluate whatever number Georgia Power gives us, right? If Georgia Power says it's going to cost X to finish it, you know, our commissioners may look skeptically at that and say, you know, I don't think this is right, because ultimately, in order for Georgia Power to receive a reimbursement or recovery for this, the commissioners have to approve anything over the certified cost. And so the big question is, how much over will it go once you subtract any guarantee from Toshiba? Remember that there's a $920 million letter of credit sitting there that we can access. And there's also a parental guarantee that in the media has been speculated that it's between $3 and $4 billion, meaning that Toshiba would have to cover that amount. And I'll confirm that it's between that amount.
Right.
Toshiba's the parent. So I think the only scenario where our ratepayers really lose a lot of money is if Toshiba themselves goes bankrupt.
Sue, sift through this for us. For the listener who may be just coming to all of this, what was the Plant Vogel expected to bring to power customers in Georgia? And that would mean what is in jeopardy at this point?
Well, the one of the reactors was supposed to be up and running by now. And so, you know, we have a project that's been pushed really far behind schedule. And we know that Westinghouse has declared bankruptcy, and there's alarming news out this week about Toshiba. They took the unprecedented step this week of releasing an unaudited third quarter earnings report. And, you know, it shows their $6.3 billion loss tied to two nuclear projects in the South. It's the two reactors at Plant Vogel, as well as two reactors being built at the Summer Plant in South Carolina by SCANA and SCENG. And the company has been unable to get the auditors to sign off on its numbers, and it risks being delisted from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, which could throw even more chaos into what's already a pretty chaotic situation.
Tim, there's already concern about the cost to power customers in Georgia as well. I want to read you a statement from one of the groups that's been overseeing this and complained about the approval of the higher cost. They said, approval of the Vogel settlement creates the largest rate impact for Georgia Power customers based on the least public review in PSC history. With today's decision, and they're talking about the decision in December, the Georgia Public Service Commissioners have wrongly rewarded Georgia Power and its partners for years of mistakes that will cost utility customers. What's your response to that?
You know, what that comment doesn't entail is all the penalties that we put on the back end if Georgia Power's late. And that stipulation, that agreement included a huge stick at the end. And I've told the power company, look, whatever number you guys come back to me with on this estimate to complete, whatever that net number is, the additional amount that you're asking our ratepayers to pay over the certified cost, look, I am going to want a Kemper-like protection for our ratepayers.
So what is a Kemper-like protection?
You know, that there's a cap that our ratepayers are liable for. And anything further, if the power company wants to complete it, is on their dime, and their shareholders are paying for it. So I do want to limit the exposure of our ratepayers.
I want to read a portion of a statement from Georgia Power. They say, quote, while we are working with Westinghouse to maintain momentum at the site, we're also currently conducting a full-scale schedule and cost-to-complete assessment to determine what impact Westinghouse's bankruptcy will have on the project, and we will work with Georgia Public Service Commission and the co-owners to determine the best path forward. Sue, what has caused, to the best of your knowledge, what's caused the cost overruns and the delays and all the different things that have troubled Plant Vogel?
Nuclear power is it's a difficult technology. And, you know, these cost overruns and delays were predicted. People testified before the Georgia Public Service Commission saying that they had concerns that this was going to happen. And the things that they warned about have come to pass. There were problems in construction. There were problems with pouring cement foundations. There were issues with equipment that was being produced at another plant and brought to the Vogel site. At one point, a reactor vessel actually fell off a train on the way to the plant. So there's just been one problem after another. And, you know, the important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we should look at where are these nuclear reactors under construction and why has it been in the South. You know, there were originally plans to build, I think it was 14 of these AP1000s, which is the type of reactor being built at Plant Vogel. All of them were slated for Southern energy markets. And, you know, you have to ask why. Why are they being built in the South? Because we have monopoly utilities, regulated monopoly utilities. The utilities in free market energy states are not interested in building nuclear power plants because essentially this technology requires massive subsidies. The reason why we saw the spate of building of nuclear reactors is because there was a law passed by Congress in 2005 called the Energy Policy Act that provided massive subsidies for this technology. And then in 2009, the Georgia legislature passed the Georgia Nuclear Energy Financing Act, which allowed Georgia Power to collect in advance from its ratepayers. The ratepayers have already put in, I think the latest figure I saw was $3.9 billion for the reactors at Vogtle. That's already sunk in there. So, you know, the experts that I've heard from have said whether the Public Service Commission decides to cancel the project or to move forward with it in whatever way, ratepayers are going to continue to pay. And I think at some point we have to ask the question, why is it that the payment setup is the way it is? Why is it the ratepayers who are bearing the risks? It's not the shareholders.
Okay, well, we have you here, Tim. You're shaking your head. Why do ratepayers bear that
first
risk?
First of all, she used the word massive, you know, in terms of subsidies. The reason these things are being built in the South is because that in places like Vermont and Massachusetts, they can't even keep existing nuclear power plants. Why? Because they're competing against wind that has massive subsidies. It's cheap natural gas and wind that's causing perfectly efficient nuclear power plants in the Northeast to close. And let me remind all of my environmental friends that when you close a nuclear power plant that has zero CO2 and you replace it with a natural
carbon
gas
dioxide,
plant,
yep.
You increase the amount. You have a net increase in CO2. So I think what broke the back of the nuclear industry is Fukushima.
The Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster in Japan.
It did. It shut down things in Japan. It shut down things in Germany. That affected France that was providing services to those two countries. Other southern states who were planning on building got out at that point, leaving only Georgia and South Carolina. And again, both of these states regulated by public service commissions. And there is a point where public service commissions will say, this is a point too far. We won't go.
So what are the chances, Tim, that, I mean, do you have an amount in your mind that Georgia Power will come back and say, this is what it's going to cost to continue this project, and you say, no, shut it down?
You know, I think with Westinghouse in Chapter 11 receiving this debtor-in-possession financing that they're getting, and they're going to tell us in about 3 weeks whether they're going to throw us the keys or whether they're going to continue. And so I don't think we have all the information yet, and a lot is going to depend on Toshiba's health and their ability to back up this parental guarantee and for us to be able to use that money to supplement our losses. And so we believe that Toshiba is too big to fail. 167,000 employees. It is the brand in Japan. And we believe that they're going to want to save face and that the government's going to intervene in Japan and save that company.
Although in the 30 seconds that we have left, Sue, you seem to be saying that we that's not necessarily the case. We don't have full confidence in Toshiba at this point.
We just don't know at this point.
Sue Sturgis is with the online energy magazine Facing South, and Tim Eccles is a commissioner with the Georgia Public Service Commission. Tim and Sue, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, does Athens have a partying problem? First, though, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz has some words for the Trump White House. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's been 10 years since author Juno Diaz published his hit novel, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. That book won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Diaz was born in the Dominican Republic and was raised in New Jersey. He formerly taught at Freedom University here in Georgia, which offers classes to undocumented immigrants. Diaz will be in Atlanta tonight for a lecture at Emory University, and I spoke with him earlier this week. There are two sides. Well, there's more than this, but certainly in terms of literature, Juno, there are two sides to your life. There's the educational portion and there's the creative portion in terms of your own writing. How different are those two jobs for you?
Well, fortunately, I have a couple of more facets, or at least locations, but, you know, I do a lot of community work, and that itself has a puts another spin on that dyad. But when I think about my creative work versus my teaching at university and at workshops, well, one of them is entirely reclusive. One of them is about wrestling heroically with one's material and one's unconscious. And the other one is really kind of a civic enterprise. Teaching is deeply embedded in our civic society. It's the kinds of teaching that I'm involved with and engaged with are linked to the best of our democratic principles about creating critical-minded, independent thinkers. And certainly there are lots of connections between being a creative person and pedagogy, but I often find them to be very, very different modalities for me. One of them is about giving as much as I can to the young people and the folks who sit in workshops or classes with me, and the other one feels very much about carving pieces of myself, and that's very different, I think.
There are authors who, I don't want to say complain, but they talk a bit about how sometimes commitments can pull you away from the writing process. In other words, the process of sort of going down into the depths of your psyche where the creative juices flow can be difficult if you're constantly being pulled out in different directions. Do you find that to be the case? Is it difficult to switch from one job to the other?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's never time. There's never time. I mean, I don't know about I don't know many people who have a pure writing life that's not interrupted by family, that's not interrupted by the daily demands of living, that's not interrupted by the fact that very few of us can live off of our work and of our writing, and therefore we have to work. Certainly there's conflicts. I mean, that's the nature of life. Being an artist is sort of trying to figure out how to make the creativity happen in between the cracks. I've been doing that my whole life, so I never knew anything different. I guess if there had been this wonderful, glorious time where I was just creative and didn't have the demands of the society or the family or paying for rent or getting food, then perhaps this would feel like a fall from heaven. But in fact, this has been sort of the baseline of my life, trying to figure out between all my other kind of commitments and responsibilities, how I can grow my fiction.
And so that makes the sacrifice of time when you give to volunteer or charitable organizations all that more valuable. So how do you choose where to put those efforts, the things that are going to take your time up or take you away from your creative work? How do you choose those?
I wish I could say that there was this very strict set of ethical criteria, but a lot of it has to do with your passion. A lot of it has to do with me, what's grabbing me at any given moment. Of course, my community is very important, the Dominican, immigrant, Caribbean, African, diasporic, you know, that kind of sort of, you know, universe to me matters deeply. But again, I've kind of been involved in the sort of community organizing or activist arena for a long time, and I you just do what you can. I never feel like I do enough. It's less, you know, that I wish I had more time for writing, and more I wish I had more time to give to, you know, the marginalized communities that I'm committed to.
So you must think back to your own school experience every time you not only enter the classroom, but, you know, when you're giving a lecture like the one you'll give at Emory. What were the things that you heard from professors or visiting scholars? What were the things that actually motivated you or inspired you that worked?
Well, one thing about being an undergrad, the way I was an undergrad was, I had a full-time job while I was going to classes. And so I was going to state school and doing the job thing. And, you know, that's pretty common for non-select college students. And what struck me most about, it's been over 20 years since I've been in university, getting close to 30 years. And what I think rings true to me still, what sort of, energizes me still is the faculty members who brought a tremendous amount of passion to their material. You know, you can never forget that. That's just something of a gift when a faculty member is just really engaged and invested in their material. And then, of course, faculty members who, for me, professors, who had very strong ethical, critical commitments. And there was also the modeling of, kindness and generosity and forgiveness. And you don't always see that in classrooms, but when I did see it, it was sort of like glimpsing pearls in mud. It was very impactful for me.
So then, first, can you explain what you mean by the ethical, critical commitment? What does that mean in a professor?
Well, folks who, have a kind of clearly stated or clearly sort of practiced sets of ethical commitments. They make it clear that that they have values around thinking. They have values around acting. Professors who are like, I'm sort of not down with misogyny. I'm not down with, oppressive systems. Professors who make it clear that there's nothing ethical about xenophobia and there's nothing ethical about racism, and that there's more to life than simply accumulating money, that we have an ethical and moral dimension, which is important for us to explore and uphold. And faculty members like that, who weren't there just to do a advanced sort of vocational training, get me ready for my job, that mattered a lot. That mattered a lot. I mean, we're not only in university to be prepared for jobs. We're supposed to be in university to receive a civic and an ethical and a critical education. And, these days in the neoliberal university, that's fallen by the wayside. But I still hold that that's among the most important elements of university life.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with novelist Juno Diaz, author of a number of books. I think one of the most recent was This Is How You Lose Her, an incredible short story collection. And I wondered, your life is very different than when you were in college. At this point, you must meet people constantly who had a really powerful emotional reaction to your writing, whether it be one of your books or stories or whatever else they've written from you. And I wonder what that is like for you as a person, as a human being, when you're constantly meeting people who your first interaction with them is them saying, your writing changed my life. How do you handle that?
Well, fortunately, that's not very common experience. I sort of live in the traditional real world of waiting online at the mail, at the post office, and getting cut off in the car and having to walk through the cold everywhere.
Yeah, you're in Boston. You must get cut off in the car a lot.
Yeah, and walking through the cold. Believe me, that's kind of the given. It doesn't happen a lot. And then again, when it does happen, I am moved and one is grateful and one is touched that one is able to provide a kind of an artistic space for someone to explore and to feel inspired and to feel moved. I mean, that's wonderful. It's something that, that keeps you to the page and keeps you to the work. But you have to understand, just for me and what my personality is, I'm always also embarrassed by that stuff. It's not my bag. I don't get a thrill out of applause. I never have. That's what made me such a lousy, athlete. You got to thrill to applause if you're going to, kind of try to excel in a public space. I like writing I like the art I do because it allows me to excel very privately. And so when that private labor, intersects with the public reaction to it, I'm always sort of flummoxed. I don't know what the hell to do. Other ones of my friends, they love that stuff. I have friends of mine, when they get recognized in the street, they just beam. I'm always like, I got to tell you, man, I have friends of mine who, if they were here listening to this, they would be nodding their head. They're like, yeah, I'm always really embarrassed and abashed, and I'm trying, I don't know. It's just never been... Yeah, I don't know.
So that brings me back to teaching, especially since you'll be speaking at Emory, and especially because you spent a good amount of time working with Freedom University here in Georgia that gives a post-secondary education to undocumented immigrants here. That brings me back to that question of then what do you tell students? What maybe advice could you give them that could have worked for you or helped you in your college or very near post-college years?
I have to tell you, young people spend most of their lives being inundated by old people giving them advice. It's probably the primary genre, the primary just medium, not even medium, but the genre, the primary discourse. They're just kind of flooded with it. I just try to, I don't give advice unless I'm asked. And what I try to do is I try to model and, model what I would think is good ethical behaviors and sort of, try to be super present, super committed, to go above and beyond for them, to center them in the classroom experience, that they're what really matters, they're what's really important, and to show what learning and being wrong looks like. I spend a lot of time in classroom being wrong. I'm not in the classroom because I know everything. I'm in the classroom because I'm a lifetime learner, and the importance of learning and what it takes to be a learner and the sort of modesty and humility and openness that is required to learn, and what it takes to confront sort of disloyalty to, what it takes to confront what's messed up about our society and to develop a disloyalty to our society's messed up rules. This is a society that's very, very sexist. And when you get some sort of education, to be a critical, ethical person means you're going to have to be disloyal to the rules of the society. And that takes courage, and that takes a certain amount of spine. And, it's an important thing to learn and to develop that in a collective. And that's what I try to do in the classroom, is to provide the collective opportunity to be able to learn some of these difficult skills and difficult values that are essential to being a learned moral person.
So then here we are in this time when a lot of things are changing, and the things that are changing are things that you have addressed in your writing in one way or another. Issues of immigration, issues of how you treat not just immigrants, but people who are foreign or foreign-born. Issues of sexism. Even the proposed defunding of the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities. These are all things that have changed since you won the Pulitzer Prize. What do you think is the role now for, has it changed for a creative person, either young or your age? What has that job changed at all?
Well, I mean, I always think it's, just because we have white nationalists in the White House, just because we have white supremacist fringe politics vaulting and sort of sliming their way into the mainstream, doesn't mean that these forces haven't always been present in our society. It doesn't mean that suddenly overnight before this, there wasn't any of this stuff crushing people down. We've had to fight and organize against this type of malign politics for as long as we've been around. And I'm not just speaking about what's the role of the artist. I'm just speaking about what's the role of the ethical citizen, certainly as a person of African descent. What's the role of somebody who comes out of the history of struggle, of my community? And so I think certainly when You've got fools like this in power and office. You've got to redouble your labors, but they're familiar labors. They're familiar strategies and modes of resistance. I just think that we have to do what we've always done well to continue to transform and to better the society. We have to continue to form positive collectives. We have to continue to develop better radical solidarities. We have to continue to be critical-minded, and we have to continue to fight injustice everywhere and fight this sort of stream, you know, this kind of vomitous stream of lies that our political, economic, and social elites attempt to throw onto us.
That is novelist Juno Diaz, never afraid to speak his mind about controversial subjects. He'll give a lecture and book signing tonight at 7:30 in Emory's Schwartz Center for Performing Arts. Juno, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.
Just ahead, does Athens have a drinking problem? This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The University of Georgia in Athens has disciplined two fraternities this school year. Last week, Phi Kappa Tau was suspended for a year after underage drinking was discovered during a hazing ritual. A ban on new bars opening in downtown Athens took effect in February. All this points to a problem with partying. And joining me is Dylan Thompson, a senior at UGA and writer for the Red and Black newspaper. Hi there, Dylan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also with us is David Lynn, Director of Planning and Outreach for the Athens Downtown Development Authority. Hi, David.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And by phone, we have Dr. Nikki Nance, a professor of human services and psychology at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida. Hi there, Nikki.
Good morning.
So let me start with you, Dylan. Do you agree that UGA has at least a partying reputation or a partying culture? Would you agree with that?
I would certainly agree with that. I mean, you know, I think when people come here as a freshman, one of the first things they hear is this stat about how there are 80 bars or alcohol selling establishments within a 1 mile radius. And I think people think about an SEC school and football and game days. And I think that image really kind of builds up in your mind, whether it tends to be true or not based on your own college experience. I think a lot of people come in with that expectation.
Dylan, you have been in Athens for how many years?
I've lived here for 3 years now.
So you just came there for college. Now, David, you have been in Athens for much longer than that. When did you arrive?
Well, I arrived as an undergraduate in 1980 and have been in Athens pretty much ever since then.
Was UGA known as a party school back then when you got there?
Oh, certainly. When I first arrived here, the university was celebrating or whatever their status as National Lampoon's number one party school.
Nikki Nance, how does a school become a party school, and does that always mean a partying culture?
I think some schools are thirstier than others, and you know, some of them, and I think especially if you've got, you know, active sports programs and fraternities, you know, those schools are going to get that reputation. And I know that some, I believe that some students are looking for that that kind of school to go to. They want to have a good time while they're in college.
Is there evidence that some universities contribute to the reputation and culture of partying, Nikki, and some universities do not?
I'm not aware of any. I don't think any school wants to, you know, that's not in anybody's promotionals. You know, your kid can drink here. Certainly it's part of a lot of campuses, and I think more some than others. Small town campuses, what I hear from students is there's not really much else to do. I think they'd still do that, even if there was a lot else to do, because big schools that I'm a little bit more so associated with before I got there, that were in bigger cities, they had plenty to do, and there was still lots of drinking. But I think some schools really do get that reputation, and I think it's because it really is the culture.
Okay, so Dylan, we actually got a tweet from somebody whose name I can't repeat on the air, who says, when I asked if drinking is a problem in Athens, this person tweeted back, problem or only thing to do. Dylan, is that, do you think part of the problem is that there's not enough to do in Athens?
I think part of the problem is definitely the perception that there's not a lot to do in Athens. You know, I mean, as far as what there actually is to do, I mean, Athens has, you know, a ton of restaurants, a vibrant music scene. There are always concerts to be able to go to. There are events put on by the university weekly and every weekend. But I do believe that, you know, a lot of students kind of perceive it that way. I mean, even, you know, as a senior with, you know, friends who I would say aren't necessarily the most inclined towards drinking, a question that I hear a lot on weekends is, you know, are you going out tonight? What are you doing? And that's always the first question. It's not really, what are you doing? It's, are you going to the bars or are you not going to the bars?
So, David, how much of this is tied up in this ban on new bars downtown? Did you support that ban?
Well, that was a moratorium.
Temporary.
A temporary moratorium with a definitive purpose and a definitive sunset that the Athens Clark County Commission passed in February, largely in response to public safety concerns on the amount of people in a small space. Some of the focus groups that I've gone to on this issue surrounding this study that the commission has initiated is focusing on ingress and egress for fire concerns and some ancillary behaviors associated with that number of people in a small city block. So I think no one would question that Athens has a vibrant and vital downtown. There's a lot of bars. And this was just an attempt by the commission to have some breathing room and reconsider if there's anything the community needed to do or could do about what's being termed these high occupancy bars, bars that are typically styled towards students and have a large number of people in them over the weekend.
So, David, how do you respond to what Dylan called the perception that there's nothing else to do in Athens but go to a bar or go to a party?
Well, I can't speak to what is attractive to someone who's 18 to 24 years old, but Athens is consistently rated as not only one of the better cities to live in the state, but even in the country. It's a typical college town in many regards. It has a very creative culture and class here. There's always something going on. It's relatively close to Atlanta, so there's opportunities there. I think there's a lot going on in Athens. Now, a lot of those things may not be attractive to the typical 18 to 24-year-old, other than socializing.
Okay, so let me go to you, Nikki, because we're talking about partying, and sometimes that's taken somewhat lightly. People don't, no, I'm not talking about officials, but I mean in general, sometimes people don't take it seriously, whereas oftentimes, especially in colleges, partying ends up resulting in binge drinking, and binge drinking is quite dangerous. What drives that phenomenon of binge drinking?
Well, I guess I'd first like to say that, you know, you've got a perfect storm of new drinkers, you know, or drinkers that are just becoming of age, the first time being unsupervised, and then of course the availability. I think the binging, but, you know, part of that is, you know, once you drink anything, the prefrontal lobe is where your judgment kind of comes from, which is underdeveloped until people are about 25 or 26 anyway. But that's, you know, you lose judgment, and so it becomes very difficult to know that you've gotten too much, and, you know, kids drink, if they drink really fast, they don't recognize that because they aren't feeling it immediately, that it's still in their body, and that's how people go all the way even to death from the binge drinking. I think the other thing that is, it's more, probably a lot more prevalent now than when I was in college, or, you know, maybe some other people. So there are a lot more people on medications, on for attention deficit disorder, a lot on medications for anxiety disorder. So even binge drinking that wouldn't be risky for somebody, that, you know, for somebody else, might be more risky for a lot of college students.
We are talking, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the possibility of a problem with partying in the city of Athens. We did invite representatives from UGA's administration to be part of the discussion. They didn't have anyone available, but we're speaking to, you just heard Dr. Nikki Nance, a Beacon College psychology professor, also David Lynn of the Athens Downtown Development Authority, and UGA senior Dylan Thompson. I just wanted to give a couple quick statistics on binge drinking since Nikki brought up the prefrontal lobe. In fact, binge drinkers are 14 times more likely to drive while impaired by alcohol, and even beside the danger to life, which it is quite dangerous. Binge drinking costs the U.S. almost $250 billion in a year's time. The most recent estimates we have on that is from 2010, so I assume they're fairly current. So Dylan, what kind of education do you think students at UGA get? When you get to UGA, do you get, I guess, information about drinking and about partying and the dangers associated?
Yeah, I mean, you do, but I would definitely say that it's something that might be taken kind of a bit lightly at large. Everyone takes a course, I believe it's called Alcohol EDU. It's an online course, and I think it's something that oftentimes kind of gets, you know, laughed off a little bit because it is online and it's mandatory, but it's something that you kind of just breeze through. You're not actually in a classroom. You're not actually hearing this from a person and being held maybe accountable to situations that are specific to Athens, but rather more about problems that are associated simply with binge drinking and some of these statistics like you're talking about in general. So one thing that I definitely think, you know, maybe students could benefit from would be, you know, programs that are, you know, not only held in person and, you know, maybe on campus as a freshman, but also very specific to some of the problems that students in Athens face specifically.
We have a tweet from Jeff Newberry who says, "Nothing to do in Athens? Nonsense. That kind of comment reveals real privilege, which may be part of the drinking problem." And in response to you, the CDC, Jeff, says that binge drinking is most common among those with a household income of $75,000 or more. And let me take that then to you, David. How do you deal with this? If this is a problem, especially at UGA, and has been, I guess, for at least since the 80s when you got there, is this the kind of thing that the university can work with the city and with all other agencies to find a cohesive strategy?
I think that a strategy could evolve from that type of discussion. As our telephone caller has indicated, this is a much larger problem than Athens, Clayton Street, and the University of Georgia. Certainly there's a demand for alcohol on one side of the street, and there's a supply of it on the other side. That supply has just been centralized downtown in the past 15 years. The demand has always been there. But I think a productive discussion between the university and an honest discussion from the university and city officials could probably result in some effective strategies.
Let me play you a clip, Nikki. This is Beth McMurtry. She's with the Chronicle of Higher Education.
What you see among colleges is that they tend to focus on education as a means for changing students' behavior. This idea that if you give students the right information, that they'll make wiser choices. But the research has shown that education without enforcement and without intervention, without trying to control the flow of alcohol on campus, really has a very limited and a very short-term effect.
So this goes directly back to what Dylan was talking about in terms of this online course, which is informational but not taken seriously. How does one change behavior? That seems to be a very difficult task for a university.
It's difficult to get people to personal, especially at a young age, you know, when they're naturally exploring a lot of things and capable to have a really good time. it's kind of difficult to get them to be internally motivated to make any changes. In my estimation, of course, I work, you know, Beacon College deals with people all who have learning disabilities or, you know, emotional problems, something. So I get to work with this a lot. That if education is from the angle of something personal to them, so when we're educating about anxiety, you know, when you have special groups in school that are support groups or, you know, safe zones for people that are high risk, that's where to start. I think when you put up the big sign, "I'm going to talk to you about alcohol," then you may as well be talking to a box of glazed donuts. They're not listening.
Dylan, do you have ideas? I mean, you suggested a few, but you must have these kind of conversations. Is there something that the university could do and is not doing?
I definitely agree with, you know, this idea that, you know, just talking about it isn't really going to solve anything. And I mean, even to what I said about there being some sort of, you know, in-person class, you know, at the end of the day, students, especially freshmen who have just gotten out of maybe, you know, their parents' house for the first time, are going to do what they want to do. And I definitely think that the university could, you know, maybe learn from some of the things that, you know, students are doing to help, because there are students that are concerned about this problem. For example, there's an organization called Designated Dogs that's offered more than 80,000 free rides home to students from downtown. And I think, you know, that the university could maybe see some of these efforts that students who are closer to the situation are taking and try to develop their own policies that can help people out. Because, you know, while the concept of an organization that drives students home from downtown is acknowledging drinking, it's at least helping the problem as opposed to just telling people, you know, don't do this, which is something that isn't necessarily going to work very well.
We have a tweet from our own Grant Blankenship who said, some of us moved to Athens for the music, not the booze. And certainly if you want to weigh in on this, maybe not even UGA, but whatever party school that may have a problem or not, you can tweet us like Grant did at OST Talk, or just give us a call at 404-500-9457. So David, is the situation worse in Athens, do you think, today than it has been, say, back in the past, in the 1980s when you arrived?
That's hard to say. It's definitely more active downtown. That's not to say that drinking didn't occur in large volumes in other parts of the community. It is part of the university culture. I mean, can you imagine a game day Saturday without alcohol? It just permeates through the college culture and probably many large institutions. But to answer your question specifically, I think the problem has shifted around. Where it was in town neighborhoods where university students rented old houses and had parties there till wee hours of the morning, that's shifted more downtown to where they're all centralized in a few city blocks.
And so, Dylan, do you think that people might hesitate to come? Is part of the partying atmosphere a draw for students?
I think it's definitely a draw as far as attending the university, but I also think that, you know, you do see kind of this, you know, irony in what's happening at UGA right now where, you know, every year the qualifications for entry are getting more difficult. You see students with higher GPAs and higher SAT scores entering the school. So obviously there is some inclination towards learning, but, you know, much to David's point there, it seems as though this kind of need for, you know, partying has not disappeared. You know, I would argue, if anything, it's increased, but it's certainly stayed the same. So I do think a lot of people, you know, might come to University of Georgia for a great education, but I think, you know, a lot of them in the back of their heads are thinking, yeah, but there are also 80 bars downtown.
That is UGA senior Dylan Thompson. We also spoke with David Lynn, Director of Planning and Outreach for the Athens Downtown Development Authority, and Beacon College Psychology Professor Nikki Nance. Thanks so much to all of you. That's our show for today, but we always welcome your ideas. Is there a safe way for college students to drink? Should there always be sort of caps and limits? Call us at 404-500-9457 or post on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.